New ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing a producer and composer known for Imperium, starring Daniel Radcliffe and Toni Collette, She's Lost Control, and Jesus Henry Christ. He's a former film festival program director who's worked with several iconic directors, including M. Night Shyamalan and Mary Harron. He also created the world's first online help desk as founder of the prize-winning tech startup GreenButton.com. Simon Taufik, thank you so much for joining us today.
Are you ready to dive in?
I'm as ready as I'm ever going to be, I think.
Fantastic. Well, let's start by having you give me and the audience the executive summary of your story and all the different hats that you wear or have worn. I believe we've got producer, composer, festival director, tech innovator. So if you want to just explain a little bit about how those pieces link together, it would be great.
It would be great because I'm trying to figure that out myself, how all of that links together. It started with me playing guitar and dreaming about having a career in music. Then I got into different passions. I was a BMX freestyle rider when I was a teenager. I got into the behind-the-curtain details of how bikes were made and all the different specifications and what the business was behind all of that stuff. And I ended up, at 13, designing a series of parts that for BMX bikes that was not currently available. And just as an experiment, and this is in the days before the internet, so I would be faxing blueprints to factories in California, not knowing that they were dealing with a 13-year-old. Long story short, it became a bit of a hit. I was selling to people all over the world out of my bedroom after school, and it was I just got into the deep end of business and of entrepreneurship because I was designing the parts, it was a great outlet for creativity. And then when high school came to an end, I got into NYU, and I sold off basically the company and decided I was going to focus on my studies and doing something that I thought was maybe more adult. So I was studying political science and economics at NYU and was introduced to M. Night Shyamalan as a fellow South Asian student. We became best of friends, and I knew nothing about filmmaking. I didn't know that there was a course of study in it or anything like that. But he, as I got to see, he was one of the most passionate people I've ever met and most driven. And so he would take me to his classes, his film classes, and I got to see how the sausage is made, so to speak. I got to see the nooks and crannies of filmmaking from the ground level. I'd go to his film sets. I would read his rough drafts. I'd go to the mix sessions. I'd meet his composers and his other collaborators, and I really got to watch as a fly on the wall, because I had no interest in the art of filmmaking. It was just a very fascinating curiosity. I had always intended, when I got into college, that I was going to pursue a career in public service as a diplomat, and along the way, I realized that the people that really changed my life and my way of thinking were not the politicians, they were the artists. So by the time college ended, my earlier exposure to computers as the young IT guy evolved into a full-time gig at NYU. And my creativity was still blossoming, and my entrepreneurial pursuits were still taking shape. And so while I was at NYU, I ended up developing the world's first online help desk. At least to my knowledge, I'd done the research. I was working full time for the university and trying to find a solution where people could remotely ask for help from their IT offices. And there was nothing for that. So I got together a bunch of students who were programmers and developers and led a project to build just that. And so that gave me the bright idea of doing a startup with an idea that was based on that, which was basically an Uber and a help desk connected together. If those two mated, you would have what we called a green button, which was essentially a button. Imagine a button on your keyboard or on your phone, and you could press that and get connected to a technical guru who could help you with whatever device you had a question on. And so the startup got a lot of notoriety. We won a bunch of awards at different tech conferences and stuff, and it was very exciting. And it tapped into, again, the entrepreneurial experience I had with BMX. And it was great. And essentially what I learned was a lot about how to sell, how to pitch. And I got to be surrounded by some amazingly creative people. And so essentially that was a 2-year window. And I cashed out of that and went right into music. And this was soon after 9/11. 9/11 happened. It really struck home because while I was at NYU, I was teaching and one of my students perished in the towers, and I had another student who was directly impacted as well. And so it really dawned on me that I needed to do something with the rest of my life before I was at the end of my life, and didn't want to be in the position of regretting those steps I didn't take. And soon after that new start, I was asked to write music for a film that was being produced by someone that I met in the startup world. He had shifted also to film, and we reconnected, and he said, "Hey, would you like to write music for my film?" And so I did that without any formal training, just based on what I had learned by watching Knight and his composer, and seeing how, and even watching them in the edit room, and it just felt like I was operating on instinct, and had a great relationship with the director of the film. She basically gave me carte blanche to do whatever I wanted musically, which is very rare. And what we ended up with was something that really resonated. And the film did very well on the festival circuit, and it was deemed a success. So I thought, okay, I do have a knack for this. Now I have to figure out what I'm doing with it. How do I actually do this again? Because I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just acting on impulse. So that got me into film. I started pursuing composition for film. And along the way, I started to try to understand how directors think and how producers think, because so much of the film can be dictated by their thought process and their decisions. That led to producing. So it was really all to try to get a leg up on how do I get onto these films as a composer, and if I understand a producer better, then I can give them what they want before they ask for it, which is a very entrepreneurial kind of thing to think about. You're thinking about your customer. You're trying to, and the Steve Jobs saying, figure out what the customer wants before they know it. In the process, I started to see opportunities that were maybe not being pursued, or they just weren't on the radar of the teams that were making or putting out these films. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity where I might be able to help this film get some legs. I might be able to help this film get on the radar of a larger audience. And in so doing, it would help my music gain an audience as well.
So you've just released Imperium, which is your largest project to date, right? And the first producing credit under your company, Atomic Features, is that correct?
That's right. Yep.
And it stars Daniel Radcliffe and Toni Collette, and it's a thriller. How did you also compose the music? Did you do both on that
project? I did some of the music. I think if I had ended up doing all of the music and produced, I think my head would have exploded. So as much as I would have loved to have done that, we quite luckily, we were very grateful to the composer, Will Bates, who came on board to compose the music, the original score. We had four producers on it, and still there was a lot to do. There still is a lot. The film was released a month ago, and there are still lots of loose ends that we have to tie up. And that's not unique to this film. It's just an example of how producing a film is very different than directing or composing, where you have certainly clearer boundaries and milestones that you meet, and then you can move on to the next project. For producing, it's a 24/7, 365-day job. You will get requests from vendors. You will get requests from press, even people who want to hire your crew in the future. You never really are able to walk away from the film. You're always going to be connected and responsible.
So you're like a parent to your film. They're always your child in one respect or another.
Yeah. I would say the director is certainly he or she is certainly the parent, but we're kind of like the godfather and godmother. You know, it's, if something happens to, God forbid, the director is out of commission, then the producer is the one who gets the call, just like the godmother or godfather. Okay, who's taking custody of this kid? We can't find the parents. They went off to Honolulu. So we get the call.
So how has, during the period of time where you moved into producing and composing, things have changed. The landscape of entertainment has changed. And how has decentralized fundraising and distribution changed how you work, both as a composer and as a producer?
It's certainly become a challenge because, budgets have shrunk. They are, because distribution is not a finite entity anymore. It's a much more it's dispersed amongst many different players now.
We're living in what some people are calling the golden age of content. And as a content producer, do you feel it's true? Is everything rainbows and pots of gold?
I think it is, but only for some. I don't think that that rainbow or that pot of gold is available to the content creators yet, and that is nothing new. I think that's always been the case, where the people who are benefiting the most are usually people on they're the last part of the food chain, and I think they're certainly benefiting from this incredible demand for original content, but they're able to call the shots just because there's that supply and demand curve where there's just simply too much of a supply of content creators. With the film schools and with the democratization of content creation tools, you've got so many people who are able to deliver content. So you look at YouTube, for example, and it started out as kind of home video stuff, and now it evolved into an alternate network or layers of networks, very polished and strategically placed videos, and there's just an abundance of material out there, and with all of this information, the networks and the buyers, they know that they're in an unusually powerful position, where I think in the past, even though there was a lot of closed information. You didn't know how much people were making or how much money was available. There also wasn't this limitless pool of talent. It was seemingly very finite. If you wanted to get a good story or if you wanted to get a good director, there were very, very few places where you could go and get that. And you had to go to the quote-unquote professionals. So that is not necessarily the case anymore. As a composer, I can tell you, at times it feels like it's a race to the bottom, because you are competing with people who are coming out of music school who are willing to work for nothing. And then you've got people on the other end of the spectrum who are Oscar-winning composers, and they are willing to work for for the same project for peanuts, just so that they can establish that relationship with these emerging directors. And so for those in the middle, you're being squeezed on both ends. And that hasn't really happened before.
One of the things that I'm curious about, given that, that there is a sort of a race to the bottom, a commoditization of art, if you will, what do you think about the trend for piracy and streaming content without payments and things like that? As a content creator, the ethos of the internet is free. A lot of millennials don't see anything wrong with obtaining without paying. How is that playing into the revenue picture?
Well, it's it was certainly the music world was the first to weather that storm and to have been the pioneer. And like most pioneers, they're the ones that we see on the path. They're the ones we see with the arrows in their backs. And so certainly the music world suffered greatly. And the big lesson from the music world was this is going to cannibalize your revenue stream. While I do, that certainly was true with music, it's not as simple as people pirating and that's the reason why. The music industry had gotten very bloated and they were certainly taking advantage of their position and delivering some very subpar content where you buy the album because you heard the single and you find out that that's the single was the only good song on the album. And so they were actually, the industry was making their content, they were devaluing the content. And so the argument is that the consumers felt like they were stealing something that really wasn't worth anything anyway. So that I don't see happening on the same level within the film and I guess new media space. I think that that's a situation where you've got content that people are very hungry for and they don't feel like they're being bait and switched for just like a trailer that looks good and then the rest of the movie is terrible. The industry really has tried to adopt piracy as part of the process. So you look at the Game of Thrones example, where it's the most highly pirated show in the world. One argument that takes advantage of that is that the folks who are stealing and pirating Game of Thrones have an abundance of time on their hands. They're students, they're young people, and they are not essentially lost revenue. They weren't buying or subscribing to HBO anyway. And so what's happening is you're getting this market, this audience that's now getting hooked on your product. And by the time that they are able to become buyers of your product, they're now hooked on your supply.
Why and so, would they ever pay for it, though? I mean, if I know how to get something for free, why would I ever pay?
Because you don't have time anymore. You had time when you were younger. And now that you have a job and you have responsibilities, because it still takes time to find this stuff. And so you got to download it. You've got to put it on whatever medium that you want to watch it on. It's too much work when it's priced so low to just buy it. And it's easier. And it's there's more of a focus on delivery mechanisms thwarting piracy than there is doing the whack-a-mole of knocking down whoever is pirating stuff. So why not figure out a way to turn those pirates into customers? Well, okay, here, have the content for free. We won't stop you. And because sooner or later, you're going to come back and you're going to want to buy it because it's as long as I have a means to deliver the product easily and that's easier than actually stealing it, then you have a reason to buy it. I mean, that was the whole rationale behind Steve Jobs launching iTunes in the midst of Napster.
Right.
The argument against iTunes was, well, why would it was exactly the question that you asked. Why would I pay for it if I can get it for free? Well, it's not just that Napster was folded because of immense legal troubles. There are a lot of copycats that are available. It's just not as easy as clicking buy on your iPhone. That's infinitely easier, and it's the product is cheap enough that it doesn't push back against the idea of buying it. So a single for 99 cents or $1.99, it's a no-brainer. The time I would have to invest in getting it for free, I'm already costing myself more than the price of just paying for it legitimately. So I think the movie industry learned from the mistakes of the music industry. So that's one thing. The other thing is that looking at content that is being pirated, it gives the studios and the content makers an idea of how popular something really is. So, for example, before Imperium came out, we were tracking all of the websites that were advertising that Imperium was going to be available on their BitTorrent sites. And we hadn't even finished the film yet. We were still in post-production. And they were basically trying to get these people to sign up for their service so that they could deliver Imperium for free.
You know, and that actually comes, one of the things I wanted to ask about that type of thing, which touches on that somewhat, is around transparency of data. Whereas when we were just dealing with theatrical releases and box office numbers, there was a concrete number that you could use. But mm-hmm. now that you have these over-the-top services, streaming services, things like that, and where you may or may not get the data and what the transparency is and if it's, you know, auditable from another source, is the lack of transparency problematic as a producer? You know, you can't maybe say that you hit certain box office numbers.
I'm all for transparency and for open information. So it certainly has been a challenge because, let's say, Imperium does incredibly well in the online space and the streaming space. We don't have at present any means of publicizing that information.
Right.
So that limits our ability to replicate the success. It limits our ability to attract new investors and to have the kind of success that if these numbers were translated into a theatrical box office, it would be cause for other parties to want to work with us. So right. whether it's us or even cast or crew, it's if you've got a hit, you want to be able to tell the world that you've got a hit. And even though we got all the way up to number 4 on the iTunes chart for general releases, that's not the same as seeing that you made $10 million the first weekend out or something like that. It's still a nebulous, it's a chart without a meaning. Being number 4 or number 1, I don't know what that really means. I don't think anybody in the movie-going public really understands what that means. It allows them to look at titles and consider those titles for purchasing, but they really don't know if this is something that a million people have seen or if it's only 10,000 people. It's really hard to gauge.
Right. This past year, there was a lot of noise around Netflix and Amazon at Sundance. Is streaming on one of those two outlets sort of the new art house circuit or not?
I wouldn't consider it an art house only because they reach so many eyeballs. So, but it's art house without, it's not art house, but it is niche. So okay. There are people who will tell you about a show and they're extremely passionate about it, and it's a hit. When you do some follow through and due diligence on a show, you find out that okay, there's this huge audience or there's a huge love for this show, and yet I've never heard of it. Right. And there are tons of these. So I just heard about Fleabag. Certainly with Stranger Things, those are hits. Yet if you walk out on the street and you ask your average person, they may not know. Well, that the number one film in this category is a hit.
Well, it's interesting because I actually worked on the promotion for Fleabag, and it is a fantastic show. It is tremendous.
Right.
And one of the other things is with the democratization of the ability to produce, with the democratization of the ability to actually put your piece up there and all of the exploding outlets, discovery of content is incredibly challenging.
Pick whoever is a star of the moment, and that's still governing how a lot of people will see a movie. You take Sully, for example, and it's people are willing to sit for an hour and a half and watch a movie about something they already know the ending of, and it's because it's being told by two very assured storytellers, Clint Eastwood and Tom Hanks, that people feel like they know what they're going to get.
That's thinking about how people will discover before you even start the
sure.
production. So you have your film and you have whoever you have in it. How do you then make people discover it?
Well, the casting is still a very large part of the puzzle. The other part of the puzzle is word of mouth. And that's where social media is really playing a huge part. So when we released the trailer for Imperium, the social networks went nuts over it. And we really were not prepared for the level of involvement that Daniel Radcliffe has amongst his fans in social media, because he's not on social media. And so he doesn't engage with it at all. He's not part of the gossip world. And so he's very removed from your typical social media star. Like the Kardashians, or pick any movie star who's active in social media. And Radcliffe does not fit that mold. And yet he's got this very avid audience. And to watch them spread the word about this film, you could see in their comments and their questions, you could see their level of engagement, and they would share it and they would respond to it. And that would increase the engagement. And
were Were you participating in the conversation, or were you just simply observing the conversation?
I was certainly participating in some of the conversation. And then there were other parts where, so we also saw a lot of comments that were, before people even saw the movie, they were reacting against the subject matter, because we found out that there was an active campaign within the white supremacist community to disavow the film and to label it in a certain way so that that would discourage people from watching it. And so we did not engage in that. And then there was a clip in the film, in the trailer, that's from a parade in Poland. And it was an Independence Day parade, but part of that parade had some neo-Nazi paraphernalia. And this was footage that we had licensed, so it was legitimate footage. But it was of part of this very large parade. And so the Polish community came out quite justifiably concerned that they were going to be labeled as white supremacists and neo-Nazis when people saw only Polish flags and some of the very extreme right-wing symbols that were being displayed in this some of this very brief footage. And so they were up in arms. I was one of the first members of the filmmaking team to tweet about the trailer and put the word out. And in my profile, I have Imperium, hashtag Imperium, in my profile. So whenever there was a member of this community that was concerned or upset about this footage, I was getting the responses. And so so I was getting a ton of feedback from this community, justifiably upset about it. And it took us a little while to be able to fix that and remove that from the trailer so it wasn't out of context. And again, this is just being an avid participant in online engagement. You know that you don't feed the trolls. That just makes it worse. And certainly our advice from our publicists and all of the other folks higher up the food chain, they basically said, yeah, we'll take care of it. And that's exactly what they did. But it turned it from serious to absurd when President Obama traveled to Poland on a summit meeting in the midst of this. And then I was getting added to tweets to him and about him saying, OK, you're going to Poland. Do you really want folks like me? And they would include me in the tweet, disparaging the Polish name and threatening relations with Poland and America and all that kind of stuff because of this movie. So it was really something to, you know, it's stuff that you can only imagine in your wildest dreams would occur, where you're now being paired up and brought into that kind of discussion. So I guess somehow
there's the internet for you, right? The speed.
The speed and the depth, and sometimes the superficiality, but somehow my wishes for being involved in foreign service somehow made its way into this.
It all matched up.
Yeah. Well,
before we wrap up there, just, I'm going to give you some words and I want you to give me your top line first thought that comes to mind after I say the word, just one word, and then we'll move on to the next word. So you're ready?
Okay.
All right. Facebook.
Parents.
Google.
Far and wide. It's not one word, but
Snapchat.
Disposable.
Twitter.
News.
YouTube.
You're confusion.
Thinking too much.
Confusion.
VR.
To be continued.
AR.
I don't know. Yeah, that one's a tough one.
AI.
Friend.
Oh, okay. And so I guess the last thing is, what are you watching? What are you consuming?
Scripts. I'm constantly reading scripts that I'm considering getting involved in as a producer or as a composer. So I'm getting a ton of scripts, and it's great that I'm being included in that conversation. But I'm a slow reader, so it's preventing me from watching what I need to. And I'm also finishing up a bunch of other projects. So it's more not what I'm watching, but it's what do I want to watch. And for me, my wish list is I want to finish watching The Nick. I want to start watching Stranger Things. I want to watch Fleabag the night of. So the star of the night of is he's going to be an EP and narrator on a feature documentary that I'm producing and scoring that just won the MacArthur Grant. So I'm excited about seeing Riz Ahmed in that show. I've been a big fan of his for a while.
Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have been indispensable to bringing this to life. As usual, first and foremost, is the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thanks, Rob. Our production team over at Microfame Media, thank you. A big thank you to our guest and new friend, Simon Taufik, and of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.